I ran across a pithy poem that may well have been written by Job. It goes, "Against a foe I can myself defend, but heaven protect me from a blundering friend." Satan's strategy toward Job was to, first of all, strip him of his wealth and then his health. But he saves the heavy artillery for later. It's interesting that he was unable to dislodge Job's loyalty through all the plagues that came upon him. But Satan was able to sort of get in the back door through his friends. You might say he failed with health and wealth, but he succeeded through stealth. He was very clever, and he was able to trick Job. What Satan's strategy was to frustrate Job to the point that it would discourage and distort his faith. I think you'll find that one of Satan's top strategies in attacking you, he tries to frustrate you and he tries to distort your perspective. If he can distort your perspective, then he has a foothold toward defeating you and he's a step ahead toward that goal. You see, a clouded faith becomes a confused faith, which ultimately becomes a conquered faith. We need to have a right understanding of God, and we need to have correct theology. It seems in the story of Job that Satan's heavy artillery were his three friends, and their restricted theology, their limited theology. They were correct, but they were incomplete. And in being incomplete, they became incorrect. They had a restricted theology. Their theology was limited. Their theology was unable to reconcile the sovereignty of God with the presence of evil in the world. They had what I call a diaper doctrine. It was a very simplistic doctrine, the kind that you pick up in Sunday school, but the kind that never develops for some people. It was the idea that God blesses good little boys and He punishes bad little boys. And so if anything bad happens to you, it's obviously because there's something evil that you've done. Of course, we know that this was not Job's situation. That Job was righteous in the eyes of God. He was blameless. And we know from chapters 1 and 2 that the reasons for Job's calamity had nothing to do with Job's conduct or his character. There was no sin on Job's part. That the reasons had to do with things going on in the heavens. There were other reasons that God allowed these things to happen, but one was not Job's sin. And yet, throughout these chapters that we've covered so far, Job's friends have been trying to pin a sin on Job, but unsuccessfully. Job has been maintaining his innocence. He has been refuting their doctrine. He has been saying, "Look, I know that it seems, according to your doctrine, according to this restricted theology, there's really only two choices. Either God is unfaithful or I've sinned." And you see, when you have that kind of limited theology, those are the only choices that are given to you. There are no other explanations. And yet there was another explanation. The truth wasn't that God was unfaithful. The truth wasn't that Job had sinned. There were other explanations that accounted for the evil and the calamities that had happened to Job. His friends were denying his friends, and his friends were persisting and persisting and persisting, and yet Job was just as tenacious in clinging to his innocence. Throughout, he says, "I'm innocent. I don't know why these things are happening to me. I wish I did know why these things are happening to me." And a lot of the dialogue is taken up with Job's cries and his prayers, "Lord, show me why." But he continues to maintain, "There's one thing I know, and that is that the reason is not my sin." In chapter 25, Job hangs up on his three friends. Enough is enough. You know, he's had it up to here. You know, he's tired. He's finished with their arguments. And what he does in chapter 26 is he sums up his feelings towards his three friends, and we'll cover that tonight, and then we'll have one more counselor who will jump in who will be much more helpful to Job, and that's Elihu, and we'll take a look at what he has to say too. Tonight, really, the arguments are much of the same. We have the same kind of arguments being proposed and then being refuted by Job. But one of the exciting things about tonight's passage is that we're going to bump across some intriguing incidentals, some things that are just said in passing that are fascinating to ponder and that perhaps will create more questions than the answers. So, chapter 26. But Job answered and said, not just to Bildad, but to all three of his counselors, "How have you helped him who is without power? How have you saved the arm that has no strength? How have you counseled one who has no wisdom? And how have you declared sound advice to many? To whom have you uttered words, and whose spirit came from you?" He's being very sarcastic. He says, how have you helped anybody? Obviously, they'd help no one, especially not Job. "The dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting them." And he begins to describe the incredible vastness of God's creation. And in doing so, the idea is to show them how little they really know about the universe and about creation. And he begins by making this observation, "The dead tremble," you know, at the presence of God. "Those under the waters and those inhabiting them." And this is intriguing. Notice the place where the dead are located. Where are the dead found? You remember in the Old Testament, the dead went to a place called Sheol, or Hades. And that was the place, the abode of the dead. That is the place and the abode of the unsaved dead even today. Of course, we know that those that are in Christ go immediately into the presence of God. But those that don't know Christ, they too go to this place called Sheol or Hades. Now notice where he describes it. He says that it's under the waters. You remember, Jesus said, as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the earth, or the heart of the earth, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Jesus was saying, as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Jesus was saying that when he died, we know he went to Hades, but he located Hades for us. It was in the heart of the earth, the center of the earth. Now, obviously, Hades, or hell, is in another dimension. It's not in the physical dimension. So when we say that it's in the center of the earth, we're not speaking of the fact that you could pry open the crust of the earth and hear the screams coming out from the inferno. That's not what we're talking about. It's in the spiritual dimension. But it's interesting that that dimension may be located in the heart of the earth. And specifically, it may be found under the waters. Now, it's interesting that throughout the Bible, the waters or the sea is always synonymous with sin. The sea has a very sinister reputation. In Revelation chapter 13, we see the beast, the Antichrist, coming out of where? Out of the sea. In Revelation chapter 9, we have demons coming up out of the mouth of the Euphrates or out of the sea. You remember when the storm cropped up on the Sea of Galilee? You remember Jesus addressed the sea and he rebuked it and the sea calmed. But it's interesting the word that was used. It said that he rebuked the sea. The word rebuke is a means of addressing a demon. And it could very well be that the storm on the sea was a result of demonic activity, an attempt by Satan to sink the boat and to sink our salvation with it. In the new earth, in Revelation chapter 22 and 23, it's interesting. What's not there? There's no sea. And you remember in Micah where it says that our sins have been taken and cast away from us. Where does it say they've been cast? To the depths of the sea. And so throughout Scripture, sea has a sinister reputation. There's evil connotations with the sea. Now, I have a book at home. It's called, and don't laugh when I say this, The Bible and the Bermuda Triangle. You laughed. But in this book, they propose some interesting theories. They say that there are places in the oceans, on the plates of the bottoms of the oceans around the world, that are associated with supernatural phenomena. And that their theory is that some of this phenomena is the result of demonic activity. They draw on the phrase that Jesus used, the gates of hell. And they say that these gates of hell are very literal. That there are some supernatural doors that allow a person to pass from the physical realm into the spiritual realm. Dimensional warps, you might call them, or corridors that allow a person who comes from this world and goes into hell. They're corridors or they're gates through which that soul passes in order to go into hell. Now that makes sense. Somehow you've got to go from the physical realm to the spiritual realm. And the idea is that these corridors or these gates are positioned beneath the sea. Here we're told that Sheol is under the waters. It's interesting that the thinnest part of the earth's crust is under the sea. It's interesting that the two deepest places in the ocean are the Puerto Rican Trench in the Caribbean and the Marianas Trench in the Pacific. And both of these places are synonymous with the Bermuda Triangle and with the Devil's Triangle. And the theory in this book is that what has happened to some of the craft and some of the things that have gone on in these areas, some of the mysterious and cryptic things, is it's a result of the demonic activity that goes on around the gates of hell. And as the demons sort of flock there and as sort of they gather there, sometimes, little demonic flashes occur in the physical realm, from these gates of hell. It's just an interesting theory. But here it would seem to sort of support it in that the dead are found where? Under the waters. And there is something, at the very least, sinister in Scripture about the sea. He goes on, he says, Sheol is naked before him, and destruction or Abaddon has no covering. You remember in Revelation chapter 9, Abaddon is the name of the king of hell, one of the demonic creatures that sort of keep the gates. He stretches out the north over empty space, and he hangs the earth on nothing. Again, he's just making comments in passing, but it's intriguing, some of the statements that he made. Remember, Job is writing 3,400 years ago, and look at the precision of his astronomical observation here, that God hangs the earth on nothing. Using all of the physics and aerospace knowledge that we've accumulated today, you still would be hard-pressed to say it any more accurately, that the earth is hanging on nothing. And yet, you compare that with some of the other ancient myths. The Egyptians believed that a egg was found in the primeval soup, and this egg hatched the sun god, and the sun god had four sons, and the sons' rivalries formed the creation. The Greeks, they believed that the earth was being held up by the arms of a tireless giant, a man by the name of Atlas. The Hindus believed that the earth was supported on the backs of three elephants who were standing on the back of a tortoise who was swimming in the cosmic sea. And so you compare these ancient myths with the Bible's account of creation and the Bible's account of it, and you see how scientifically specific and accurate the Bible actually is. It's amazing. Again, this man is writing 3,400 years ago, and he writes with this kind of scientific precision. Notice also he says he stretches out the north over empty space. For years, the astronomers have pondered and have been perplexed why there seems to be a blank space behind the North Star in the horizon, in the night sky. There just seems to be a blank spot behind it. And here it says that he stretches the north out over the empty space. There are some theories and some people that believe that just as hell is located in the spiritual dimension at the center of the earth. Heaven is located in the spiritual dimension in the north. You remember in Psalm 75, verse 6 and 7, it says, "For exaltation comes neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south. But God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another." But notice the direction that's left out. From the north. He says it doesn't come from the east, west, or south. But he leaves out the fact that it may come from the north. Indicating that that's where God comes from. We'll see that in chapter 37 tonight. When we see God coming again from the north. It's just intriguing thoughts. That he just sort of drops in passing. That he really doesn't stop to elaborate on. But definitely whet my appetite. He goes on and he says, "He binds up the water in his thick clouds, yet the clouds are not broken under it." And here again, he's talking about the pre-flood world. And we studied that back in Genesis and how we talked about the possibility of a vapor canopy at one time having shrouded the world, actually creating a tropical paradise, that the antediluvian world, or the world before the flood, was a tropical paradise actually existing in a greenhouse kind of an effect. He says, "He covers the face of his throne and he spreads his cloud over it. He drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness." Isn't that beautiful imagery? That God paints the sunsets and the sunrises. That these are actually God's way of painting His beauty and His art in the sky. Notice it says He paints on the circle of the horizon. Now that obviously means that the Bible considered the earth to be a sphere. Again, 3,400 years, about 3,000 years before Columbus. The Bible said that the world was round. Columbus never really had anything on the Bible. I mean, the astronomer, that's where the astronomers got it from, is they understood, those that read the Bible understood what the real nature of the earth was. It was a sphere. He says, "The pillars of heaven tremble and are astonished at his reproof. He stirs up the sea with his power, and by his understanding he breaks up the storm," or literally, he breaks up the Rahab, or the twisting serpent. "By his spirit he adorned the heavens, his hand pierced the fleeing serpent. Indeed, these are the mere edges of his ways, and how small a whisper we hear of him. But the thunder of his power, who can understand?" Now here he's describing creation again. And yet he does so in a very unusual way. A way that's not apparent from the text in Genesis. Is that as he's talking about God's creating the world, he depicts the creation as a battle between God and a creature called Rahab, or the twisting serpent. This twisting serpent is also referred to back in chapter 4. He's called chapter 3, he's called Leviathan there. We'll run across Leviathan again. But that the creation itself, we think of it as being a very peaceful kind of an act. You know, that God is standing there and he's simply speaking these things into existence, but there's a harmony at the outset of it. And yet that may not have been the case at all. The creation may have been confronted by Satan. There are many Jewish traditions that say that Satan was there in the creation, at the outset of the creation, trying to thwart God's creation, trying to keep it from occurring, trying to prohibit you and I from being created. Because ultimately we would be reigning and ruling over the angels. Satan knew that he didn't want that. Not these little mud balls reigning over him. And so he was there at the outset to try to prohibit it. It's an interesting picture here. God is creating. And yet Satan is there as a serpent in the sea, trying to confront and to prohibit the creation. Remember in Genesis chapter 3, when we first see Satan, what does he appear as? As a serpent. The Oriental idea of the serpent. You know, you go to these Chinese restaurants and there's dragons all over the wall. What's a dragon? Well, it's a serpent with legs. And what was Satan when he appeared to Adam and Eve? He was a serpent with legs. It's interesting that if you go and you look into a lot of the different creation stories in a lot of the cultures throughout the world, there's a common storyline that reoccurs over and over again, and that is that the Creator conquered a serpent and chopped the serpent up into pieces, and then took the serpent, the pieces of the serpent, and used the serpent as the stuff of creation. Now, we know that's not how God created the heavens and the earth. He created it out of nothing. But it is interesting that the same elements are part of these stories that are part of the biblical story when you look past Genesis into some of these other accounts. You remember in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, you remember God, He begins His creation with what? The earth is without form and void. Darkness is upon the face of the what? The deep. And the Spirit is hovering over the waters. Perhaps the Spirit, perhaps in those waters was Leviathan himself, or this twisting serpent. And the whole creation was born out of a battle. This battle continues to rage. At every turn that God makes in biblical history, the serpent raises his head again in order to try to confront and contradict God's plan. It's interesting that in Psalm chapters, I think it's chapter 75, it talks about Leviathan appearing again in the Red Sea. When God parted the Red Sea, him trying to prohibit that miracle from taking place. And we don't see it in the accounts in Exodus, but the psalmist talks about how God overcame the power of the serpent in order to part the Red Sea, in order to lead the people through on dry ground. And so just some real spiritual battles going on between God and the dragon. You remember God finally has enough of the dragon in Revelation chapter 12, during the middle of the Great Tribulation. And what does He do with the dragon? Boots him out of heaven. But again, this struggle, this battle has been raging from creation, and it continues even today. Notice he concludes, indeed, these are just the mere edges of His ways. I mean, He's intrigued us. I mean, these are things that we didn't know. These are things we'd never heard of. And yet, He says, hey, these are just the mere edges of His ways. There's so much that we don't know. It's amazing. Today's mysteries, I mean, yes, tomorrow's, the basic building blocks of tomorrow's science are still today's mysteries and secrets. And we're constantly learning new things about the creation, and we just know the edges of His ways. We just know a fraction of what all God has truly created and His ways and His workings. In chapter 27, Job continued his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter? As long as my breath is in me and the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say, you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. Job refuses to plea bargain. He's going to maintain his righteousness to his dying day. He is innocent, and that none of these things that have happened to him are the result of his sinning. And he goes on in chapter 27, and he basically warns his friends that, you know, they've been talking about how that God heaps it on the wicked. Well, they've been acting very wickedly themselves, and so they better be careful, or God is going to bring some heavy judgments upon them. And then in chapter 28, he begins by noting the technological advances of his day. And specifically, he points out the different techniques by which men had learned to mine the minerals from the earth, and how the different ways in which man has learned to extract the gold and the precious jewels and minerals and all from the earth. It's interesting, he says in verse 5, he says, as for the earth, from it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. There he pictures the center of the earth as a boiling cauldron, a fire existing in the center of the earth. That's some pretty interesting information for somebody who lived 3,400 years ago. Pretty interesting idea for him to come up with. He goes on, he talks about some of the ways that they've channeled, they cut rocks, cut out channels in the rocks, and He's just talking about the advances of that day. And yet he bemoans the fact that despite these technological advances, despite the fact that man has learned how to extract minerals from the earth, he bemoans the fact that man is unable to extract wisdom. That he can do all these wonderful things, but he still lives without wisdom. He's unable to mine it from the earth. He's unable to buy it with his gold. He's unable to purchase it. It's impossible for him to find wisdom. Well, isn't that a fitting description of our day to day? Well, we live in a world of technological marvels. These smart bombs that we've seen on TV, you know, and in this last war, you know, where they go to their target, hit their target through the laser guidance systems in these bombs. It's amazing. You know, the way we've been able to harness the power of the atom, the way now we're able to splice the basic building blocks of life through the genetic techniques and genetic engineering, the marvels that we've been able to produce through our technology and through our intellect and understanding. And yet we can't even learn to get along with each other. We can't learn to love our wives. We can't learn to be successful in our relationships. We have all this knowledge. We can extract all this from the creation, but where is wisdom? He tells us in verse 23, he says, God understands its way. And he knows its place. God knows where wisdom is. And if a man wants wisdom, he must seek God. He says in verse 27, then he saw wisdom and declared it. He prepared it. Indeed, he searched it out. And to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. This is the beginning of wisdom. You want to extract wisdom, you go to God. It's to fear and reverence and respect God. That's the beginning of wisdom. But Job further continues his discourse and says, and here you could sort of sum up chapter 29 as the good old days. And Job sort of reflects back on the times when he was prosperous and respected and a pillar of the community. He says, oh, that I were as in months past. Notice, this whole thing now, it's not been days since all this befell him, but it's not been years either. It's been months. So we can think that maybe a year or so now, or less than a year or so has transpired since his loss of his health and his family and so forth. But as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and when by his light I walked through darkness, just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were around me, when my steps were bathed with cream, and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me. These were the good old days, the days when he was living there, you know, in God's blessing and prospering and enjoying life. He says, when I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the open square, the young men saw me and hid, and the aged arose and stood. In other words, I was respected. And he goes on, he talks about how that, you know, he gave to the poor. You know, he was there when people needed someone. You know, over and over again, Job just basically talks about what a good guy he was. You know, I was eyes to the blind and I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor and I searched out the case that I did not know. I broke the fangs of the wicked and plucked the victim from his teeth. Even goes on in verse, in the last few verses, he says, when I listened, you know, people stopped. They, when I spoke, people stopped and they listened to me. Job was like E.F. Hutton. You know, when he spoke, people listened. They paid attention to him. They respected his opinion. They considered him to be a chief. He was really a ruler in the community. And he was looked on with respect. And what Job said, you know, it carried such weight that that became the rule of the day. Notice in verse 18, he says, but then I said, I shall die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. My root is spread out to the waters and the dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is fresh within me and my bow is renewed in my hand. You know, he said, man, if things were going so good, I just figured I would just sort of ride the train right on out, you know. Things were going so good. I was so content. And I just figured that this was the way it was going to be, and this is how I was going to live out the rest of my days. You know, we need to be careful. When we become content, and when we become at home in this world, God is sure to rock the boat whenever we get comfortable. Because God does not want us content and at home in this world. You know, it was said of Jesus that He came to comfort the disturbed and to disturb the comfortable. And whenever you begin to think that you finally found the groove, you know, man, this is it. This is just the way it was meant to be. I'm going to ride out the rest of my days, right? You know, you can be sure that God has some surprises for you. He wants to keep you guessing. He wants to keep you trusting in Him. You see, Job, he was doing so well. You know, things were going so well for him that, you know, why trust in God? I mean, he just kind of got into a groove. He was enjoying God's blessing. He was doing all the right things. All the right things were happening to him, and everything's kind of becoming automatic. God doesn't want an automatic relationship with you. God wants you seeking Him. God wants you responsive to Him. And the way He does that sometimes is through pain. It's through suffering. He intervenes in our little comfort, and He rocks our boat. And suddenly we run into a trouble. We get down on our knees and say, God, we need Your help. God says, great. That's where you needed to be all along, on your knees, right here in front of me, before me. And so God will use suffering and pain to wake you up sometimes and to end your comfort and to get you trusting Him and get you back on track, seeking Him, just as He did Job. Chapter 30. But now they mock at me, men younger than I, whose fathers I disdained to put with the dogs of my flock. You hear what he's saying? He's saying, the sons of the men who I relegated to the dogs, you know, the sons of the men that I used to excel over, they're now mocking me and taunting me. You know, Job has become the Rodney Dangerfield of Edomites. So I no longer get any respect. Everywhere I go, I don't get any respect. You heard what Rodney said. He said this dog ran up to the door and started barking at the door. So he went to open the door to let his dog run out. And as he opened the door, he found that the dog didn't want to leave. He wanted him to leave. Didn't get any respect from his dog. But Job feels like I don't even get respect from the dogs. You know, the dogs don't even care about me, you know. And he's just really struggling. It's pretty bad when you're so low that the down and out look down on you. And that's how Job feels. You know, he's that low. He's lost it all. He once was, his opinion was respected. And doesn't that hurt more than anything else when you lose your respect? When people who once respected you no longer you can sacrifice your riches, but it's your respect that hurts. And he's lost it all. Notice in verse 11, I think this is vivid imagery. He says, because he has loosed my bowstring and afflicted me. He says, I feel like a limp bowstring. That's kind of like feeling good for nothing. Just a limp bowstring. I'm no longer taut. I'm no longer used. I'm no longer looked on as being useful. He says in verse 16, and now my soul is poured out because of my plight. The days of affliction take hold of me. My bones are pierced in me at night, and my gnawing pains take no rest. Many of these, I'm sure, were literally the physical things that the boils and his disease were creating and causing. By great force, my garment is disfigured. It binds me about as the collar of my coat. He has cast me into the mire, and I have become like dust and ashes. I cry out to you, but you do not answer me. And this was the source of his greatest torment. If God would just tell him why, he could cope. If he just knew why these things had happened to him, he could deal with it. He could deal with the poverty. He could deal with the disrespect. He could deal with all the things he'd lost. If he just knew why. Ever felt that way? If he just knew why it had happened, you could cope with it. You could deal with it. And yet apparently, there are some things that God doesn't want us to know why. There are some things that God does that He does not offer an explanation. There are some things that God does in our lives that an explanation does not come with them. And God teaches us something through those situations. He teaches us that we don't really need to know why sometimes when we know God. God will speak to Job. Job's prayers are not going unheard. God will come to Job. But it's interesting. He will not come to Job with answers. But He'll come to Job with some questions of His own. And we'll see some important lessons that Job learns. To the very end, even after Job's prosperity and his health and everything's restored to him, Job never learns why these things have happened to him. Always remember, Job never read the first two chapters of Job. And to the very end, he never knows why. And there's some things that you'll never know why. You can figure them out and scratch your head and pray for answers. There's some things God won't tell you why, but there's a reason. And in denying you an answer, He will give you far, far more. And we'll study more about that next week. Notice what else Job says. He says, "I stand up and you regard me, but you have become cruel to me. With the strength of your hand you oppose me. You lift me up to the wind and cause me to ride on it. You spoil my success, for I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living." Now, were those things true? No, those things weren't true at all. God didn't oppose Job, and this was not going to be his destiny. He was not going to bring him to death and strip him of all his... God was going to restore him. None of these things are true. But I want you to understand something. In asking why Job lost his way, the more he began to ask why, the more distorted his perspective on God became. The more he asked why, the smaller God became in his thinking, and the bigger Job became in his thinking. He becomes proud. He becomes impatient. He's no longer the same humble individual that we see in the beginning. Something happens in Job. In his attempt to vindicate himself and defend himself, he loses his respect and reverence for God. In seeking why, he loses his way. Be aware of the fact that pain can cause serious distortions in our perspective. Listen to the words of one man. He says, "Pain speaks a strange language. It plays funny tricks on us. It makes us think things and say things and even believe things that aren't true. When pain begins to bore its way through human flesh and into the human spirit, and then just sits there and hurts and hurts and hurts, the mind becomes clouded and the brain begins to think strange thoughts like, 'God is dead,' or 'God's gone fishing,' or 'God doesn't care about me.' Pain can pervert our understanding and it can distort our perspective if we're not very, very careful. And it can cause us to draw wrong conclusions about God. Satan knew what he was doing through these three friends and through the persisting of this pain, because he knew that Job, in his limited theology, was unable to cope with the events that had happened to him. And so because of the pain and the unanswered questions, he began to draw false concepts. And his pain began to cloud his perspective and his understanding of God. Be careful that you don't let the pain and the suffering that you experience cloud your understanding of who God really is. In chapter 31, Job begins to clean out the closets. And you know, that's something that we all do whenever something begins. We begin to suffer, things don't go our way, and suddenly we start cleaning out the closets, you know. Well, maybe it's because of this, maybe it's because of that. And so Job, you know, he takes that same approach, and so he starts going through all the skeletons, and he starts exposing every area of his life, you know, just to prove that there's nothing he's hiding. And so in verse 1, he says, I've made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? Just don't think I've lusted after a woman. That's not the reason these things have happened. And he goes on, he talks about all the horrendous things that he wishes God would do to him in the event that it was a case of lust. You know, do this to me, do that to me, you know, punish me for it. If that's the problem, punish me for it and let's get it over. But that's not the problem. In verse 13, he says, If I have despised the cause of my manservant, if I've mistreated my servants, in other words, you know, here are the things that you should do to me. In verse 16, if I've kept the poor from their desire, or if I've caused the eyes of the widow to fail, if I've mistreated the poor and the down and out, you know, here's what should happen to me. But again, that was not the case. In verse 24, if I have made gold my hope, or said to find gold, you are my confidence. If I've made gold my God, if I've become materialistic, you know, punish me, God. Strip me of this and strip me of that. And he goes on what he suggests God do to him. Verse 29, if I've rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me, if I've taken a little too much joy in the punishment of my enemies, you know, Lord, punish me and end this pain that I'm suffering. You know, if I've mistreated the stranger who's come to me and who's needed help. Finally, he finishes up in verse 38. If my land cries out against me and if its furrows weep together. In other words, if I've been unethical in my business. If I've mistreated the land. Here's a plea for conservation. In the oldest book in the Bible. The book of Job. You know, if I've mistreated the land. If the furrows are offended by what I've done. You know, punish me, Lord, and give me my due. And in verse 40 it says, the words of Job are ended. And that's the last we hear from Job. So these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. Also against his three friends his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. Now because they were years older than he, Elihu had waited to speak to Job. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, his wrath was aroused. And so Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, answered and said. Now, as these three men are questioning Job, and as Job is responding, eight different rounds of questions and responses, there's another man who's been sitting there in the ash heap, you know, just watching, observing what's going on. He's a young man, and he's been respecting of age, and so he knows these guys are older, and so he's letting them speak first, but he's been sitting there and he's been observing what's going on. And he's gotten angry as he's been listening. He's been gotten angry at Job's three friends and he's gotten angry at Job. He's gotten angry at Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar because he sees that they've been accusing Job without proper evidence. That they've not been able to pin a sin on Job. And so they've resorted to falsifications and they've dreamed up things against Job. And he's angry at them because of their mistreatment of Job. But he's also angry at Job because he's seen what has happened to Job. He has seen that a humble man, one who in the beginning was literally and simply perplexed and puzzled about what he didn't understand, that he's seen that attitude change. Job is no longer asking honest questions. Now Job is asking questions that reek with sarcasm. Now Job is arrogant about his own defense and his own righteousness. He's adamant that God is unfair in the way he's treated him. And Elihu has the wisdom to see what has happened to Job. And he's angry that now Job is more concerned with defending himself than he is with vindicating God's character and God's judgment. He's more concerned about proving himself right than he is about God's reputation and God's holiness. And he sees that how Job has lost his respect and his reverence for God, and he gets angry about that. And so in verse 6, he begins, I am young in years, and you are very old.
Therefore I was afraid and dared not declare my opinion to you. I said, age should speak and multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there is a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. Great men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. I learned that some of the courses I took down at Georgia State, that great men are not always wise. There were a lot of fellows down there that had all sorts of intelligence, all sorts of scholarly degrees, but I wondered how in the world they buttoned their shirts in the morning. I mean, we had one professor who missed the first day of class. He came on the wrong day. You know, intelligence and wisdom are not synonymous. And there are a lot of people that have all sorts of intelligence, but they have no common sense whatsoever. I mean, they have brilliant minds, but they're bankrupt when it comes to common sense. T.S. Eliot, who you would consider to be an intellectual himself, was writing about his profession and about his like. When he wrote the poem, Hollow Men, he said, "We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men. Learning together, headpiece filled with straw. Alas, our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless as wind in dry grass." Just because you know a lot, just because you have a lot of intellectual wisdom or degrees or scholarly ideas, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have wisdom. Doesn't necessarily mean that you've understood things or you've put things together. Just go down to the biology department at Georgia State. Take a survey as to how they believe that the earth was created and the origins and so forth. It's pretty foolish, some of the theories and all. Don't be intimidated by great men. They're not always wise. He goes on and he says, listen, you've had your say. You three guys have had your say. Now it's time to hear from me. So in chapter 33 he says, "But please, Job, hear my speech and listen to all my words. Now I open my mouth. My tongue speaks in my mouth. My words come from my upright heart. My lips utter pure knowledge. The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life." You'll notice that Elihu doesn't lack for yeah, modesty. I mean, he's definitely thinks that he has arrived. He's not intimidated. I'll put it that way. I mean, he thinks that he's arrived. He thinks he has the inside track. But it is interesting about Elihu that when God later comes back and judges the three friends and punishes them for the way they treated Job, he does not punish Elihu. So it could well mean that he, you know, I guess by not punishing him, he was actually vindicating him. He was actually approving of what he had said, or at least most of it. And so we need to be careful before we come down too hard on Elihu. Some of the things Elihu says are good. Some of the things he says are bad. It seems like the difference between Elihu and Eliphaz and the other three guys is that Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar become instruments in the hands of Satan. Whereas even though Elihu is not right in everything, he remains an instrument in the hands of God. And what God does with Elihu is he uses Elihu to wake Job up and to sort of refocus Job's perspective on who God is. And so Elihu, in a sense, becomes a preparation for God appearing to Job in chapter 38. Now he says, "If you can answer me, set your words in order before me. Take your stand. Truly I am your spokesman before God." You remember Job had prayed for a mediator, someone who would be his spokesman. And Elihu's stepping up and saying, "Hey, I'll be your spokesman. I'll be your mediator. I also have been formed out of clay. Surely no fear of me will terrify you, nor will my hand be heavy on you. Surely you have spoken in my hearing, and I word, saying, I am pure, without transgression. I am innocent, and there is no iniquity in me. Yet he finds occasions against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks. He watches all my paths. He's just repeating what Job has said. Look, in this you are not righteous. I will answer you. For God is greater than man. Why do you contend with him? For he does not give an accounting of any of his words. Now, what Elihu does here is he does not question the issue that the three friends in Job have been debating. And that was whether Job initially had sinned or not. That's not what he questions. But what he says to Job is that really doesn't matter now. Whether you were innocent in the beginning or not really doesn't matter now, because if you were innocent then, you're guilty now, because look at how you've sinned in the process. You see, Eliphaz and the three friends, they concentrate on the cause of Job's calamity. But what Elihu zeroes in on is the mistake and the rebellious attitude that has been developed in Job since the calamity. In struggling with the questions and asking why, in trying to vindicate himself, Job, what has been created in Job is a hard heart and a wrong attitude. And so what Elihu zeroes in on is the aftermath of the calamity and how the pain has distorted Job's perspective and has created a problem within Job. So he says, all that doesn't really matter now. He says, for God is greater than man. In other words, do you see what you've been doing, Job? You've been elevating yourself. And you've been showing less and less respect for God. He says, God has done something here, and he has chosen to give you no answer. You should be satisfied. What right do you have to demand of God an answer? What right do you have? What does God owe you? God owes you nothing. Job, you've forgotten that you're a man and that God is God. You've forgotten that God is sovereign. That God created you. God can do with you as He pleases. That's what sovereign means, that God can do as He pleases because He is God. We're not talking about some kindergarten God who's obligated to people when they do good to give them a little star. That's not the kind of God we're talking about. We're talking about a God who's obligated to no man. We're talking about a God who does as He pleases, who sets His own rules, who makes His own rules, and changes them if He wants in the middle of the game. We're talking about a sovereign, autonomous, omnipotent God. And he says, you've forgotten about that God, Job. He says, for God may speak in one way or in another. And he goes on, he talks about how that, you know, it is God's custom to provide a mediator. It is God's custom to provide a ransom for a man's soul and to redeem a man and to set him back and give him life and strengthen him and secure him. In chapter 34, he says, hear my words, you wise men. Give ear to me, you who have knowledge. For the ear tests words as the palate tests food. Let us choose justice for ourselves. Let us know among ourselves what is good. For Job has said, I am righteous, but God has taken away my justice. Should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. What man is like Job, who drinks scorn like water, who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with the wicked men? For he has said, it profits a man nothing that he should delight in God. That was the conclusion that Job had drawn. You know, here I am, I've lived a righteous life, and see where it's gotten me. So, I mean, it's really meaningless to trust God. It's meaningless to serve God. And Elihu says, wait a minute, Job. You've allowed your pain to cloud your perspective. You know, that's not true. And he says, we're not going to let Job sit here and say these kinds of things. And so he goes on and he explains again how that God does hear the wicked. I mean, he does see the wicked and he punishes the wicked. He does hear the righteous and he rewards the righteous. It says in verse 21, for his eyes are on the ways of man and he sees all his steps. You know, what he's saying to Job is that, Job, you've given up too soon. You know, God has allowed this suffering to occur for a season. But eventually, God does reward the righteous and God does judge the wicked. You've just given up on God too soon. You've concluded that God is unfair. When God is not unfair, you're just impatient. And notice what he says in verse 34. He says, "Men of understanding say to me, wise men who listen to me, Job speaks without knowledge, his words are without wisdom. Oh, that Job were tried to the utmost, because his answers are like those of wicked men. For his rebellion to his sin, he claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God." Notice what he's dealing with. You've added rebellion to your initial sin. There was no initial sin to begin with, but that's what he's approaching. He's not approaching what caused the calamity, but he's saying, look what's happened to you since. Look at how you're questioning and all you're going through. You're questioning and doubting. Look how it soiled your attitude and destroyed your love and your loyalty to God. And just the respect and reverence you had for God. I like what one man said. Where God has placed a period, never put a question mark. Where God has placed a period, never place a question mark. If God hasn't given you a reason, you need to be satisfied with that. You make a great mistake by questioning and asking why. You know why he would. There's something to be learned here. Are we willing to submit to the sovereignty of God? Are we willing to let God be God in our lives and not buck Him and not doubt Him and not question Him? But are we willing to let God be God? In chapter 35, he says, "Moreover, Elihu answered and said, 'Do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? For you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned?'" Again, he's saying that righteousness doesn't pay. That he'd have the same plight as if he had sinned. And Elihu contradicts that. He says, that's not true. You know, God rewards the righteous. He punishes the wicked. He says that whether he was right or wrong in the beginning doesn't matter now. Because now he's sinned anyway. And it's because of the hardness of his heart that God is unable to speak to him. Even if God wanted to speak to you now, Job, God can't. Because look at the rebellion in your heart. Look how you harden your heart against God. Look how you lost respect for God. And he tells God, Job, that his problem is twofold. It's pride and it's impatience. You know how impatient we are. God, we want you to set it right now. Alleviate my suffering now. Punish that guy now. You know, set things right. Let's see justice now. We're not willing to wait on God to fulfill his other purposes, the other purposes that are involved that we might not know about. Chapter 36. Elihu also proceeded and said, "Bear with me a little and I will show you that there are yet words to speak on God's behalf. Job, you've been so busy defending yourself. Let me defend God for a minute." He says, "I will fetch my knowledge from afar. I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker. For truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you." And again, no lack of modesty here, I'll tell you. "Now behold, God is mighty but despises no one." Now you see what he's saying there? He says, Job, you've drawn the conclusion that God, you know, he picked you out for special torture. You know, that he's been despising you, that he had a grudge for some reason against you. God despises no one. God doesn't pick somebody out for special punishment. God doesn't pick you out to make you a little whipping boy. That's not the way God operates. He says, "He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not preserve the life of the wicked, but gives justice to the oppressed." And again, he goes on and says basically the same things that he's been saying. But notice in verse 22, "Behold, God is exalted by his power. Who teaches like him? Who has assigned him his way? Or who has said, 'You have done wrong'? Who can counsel God? Who can rebuke God?" And you see, that's what had happened to Job. You see, he had become God's counselor. He had three counselors of his own, but he had become God's counselor. He had begun to accuse God of treating him unfairly. Who is Job to tell God what is fair and what is not fair? Who are you to tell God what is fair and what is not fair? Who are you to question what God does in your life? God is God. He says, remember to magnify His work, of which men have sung. Every man has seen it. Man looks on it from afar. Behold, God is great, and we do not know Him, nor can the number of His years be discovered. You've forgotten who the eternal God is. You've taken your eyes off God. And what he tells God, Job here, is that you need to get your eyes back on God. You begin to need to sit down and think about who God is, who this is that you've been questioning, who this is that you've been doubting. Then in chapter 37, or actually, let me read in verse 30 there. It's interesting. It says, look, he scatters his light upon it and covers the depths of the sea. For at these he judges his people. He gives food in abundance. He covers his hand with lightning. Notice he actually says, look at the lightning. Look at the thunder. And there are some that believe that as Elihu is speaking, there is a thunderstorm that's brewing off into the distance. And so he very literally reaches out and he points that thunderstorm. Now, we know in chapter 38 that God speaks to Job out of the whirlwind. So this thunderstorm apparently is no ordinary thunderstorm. This is the thunderstorm that God is in, and he's going to speak out of this whirling of the wind and this storm that arises. He's going to speak to Job specifically. And so Elihu basically begins to act as the MC, and he introduces God off in the distance as the storm brews and comes forward. Notice in verse 37, it says, at this also my heart trembles and leaps from its place. Hear attentively the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. He sends it forth from the whole heaven, his lightning to the ends of the earth. After it, a voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain them when his voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with his voice. He does great things which he cannot comprehend. He's saying, Job, very soon you're about to literally hear that voice rumbling and thundering out of the storm. He says, for he says to the snow, be on the earth, likewise to the gentle rain and the heavy rain of his strength. He seals the hand of every man, that all men may know his work. I really love it when it snows here in Atlanta. It's amazing. Everybody's running around so busy. I've just got to do this. You've got to do that. You've got to be here. You've got to be here. And then suddenly, in 30 minutes, God can shut everybody down. All this important stuff, all this busyness, and all this important, we had to be here. And suddenly God can just say, wait a minute, wasn't all so important after all. 30 minutes, he can shut the whole city down. He goes on, he talks about how he controls nature. He sends the animals to hibernate. You know, he brings the ice and freezes the waters and all the ways that he moves, and he controls nature. And then verse 14, listen to this, O Job, stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know when God dispatches them and causes the light of his cloud to shine? Do you know the balance of the clouds, those wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? Why are your garments hot when he quiets the earth with the south wind? With him have you spread out the sky, strong as cast metal mirror. Were you there when he hung the heavens, Job? He says, teach us what we should say to him. For we can prepare nothing because of the darkness. Should he be told what I wish to speak? If a man were to speak, surely he would be swallowed up. Look how arrogant you've been, Job. Look how you've been speaking to Almighty God. Flippantly and sarcastically and abrasively. You've lost your humility, Job. You've forgotten who God is. And what's worse, you've forgotten who you are. Verse 22, he says, he comes from the north. That's where God comes from. From the north as golden splendor. With God is awesome majesty. As for the Almighty, we cannot find him. He is excellent in power, in judgment, in abundant justice. He does not oppress. Therefore, men fear him. He knows no partiality to any who are wise of heart. And so he's preparing Job. Getting his perspective back correct and focused again. And Job is going to hear from God himself when we pick it up next week in chapter 38.